It's time for security now. Steve Gibson's here. He's got a wrap-up on all the big security news, including his take on the Satoshi Nakamoto drama playing out right now with Dr. Craig Wright. He also talks a little bit about new problems with Android. Yeah, there's another stage fright bug. And we'll answer five more questions from our great audience. Security Now is next.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Security Now is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com. This is Security Now with Steve Gibson, episode 558, recorded Tuesday, May 3rd, 2016. BitCon. Security Now is brought to you by FreshBooks, the super simple cloud accounting software that's giving thousands of freelancers and small businesses the tools to save time billing and get paid faster. Try it free at freshbooks.com/securitynow. And by Thinxt Canary. Detect attackers or malicious insiders on your network with honeypots that can be deployed in minutes. For 10% off and a 60-day money-back guarantee, go to canary.tools/twit and enter the code TWIT in the How Did You Hear About Us box. And by Carbonite. Keep your business safe this year. Protect files on your computer or server with automatic cloud backup from Carbonite. Try it free without a credit card at carbonite.com today. Use the offer code SECURITYNOW to get 2 free bonus months when you decide to buy. It's time for Security Now, the show where we cover your security and safety online. Makes it sound scary. It's actually a great show, a fun show, where you learn a lot about technology with this guy, Steve Gibson. Hey, Steve.
Hey, Leo. Great to be with you again. We only got 4 of our nominally 10 questions in last week because we had so much to talk about. And I have a similar concern this week because there's lots of fun stuff has happened. Congress has passed an email privacy act. Edward Snowden and Fareed Zakaria debated for an hour on the issue of encryption. We still have this question of can you be compelled to have your finger pressed against the iPhone unlock button up in the air. Android has continuing problems with the media server module, which, of course, we were introduced to with the exploits known as Stage Fright. And Google has, in fact, renamed their monthly security now from Nexus Security Update to Android Security Update, acknowledging that Android ecosystem is bigger than just Nexus. WhatsApp was ordered shut down again by the same moron, judge, and we found out what WTF is in Portuguese. then, of course, everyone wants to know.
But it's back, you know. The higher court overturned it once again.
Yeah, so, yeah. 1 hour. One day. It was supposed to be out for 72 hours, and it's like, okay, it's back up the next day. And it was the same judge.
Was anyway, it? I thought it was we'll a talk- different, it's a different case, though, right?
A different case, same judge. Oh, he just funny. Is
he
annoyed.
Like you don't like him.
Yeah. Then the question is, do we finally know who Satoshi Nakamoto is? And it's funny, too, because in my show notes, I put, will the real Satoshi Nakamoto please stand up? And I thought, you know, I wonder if our audience is too young to understand that reference.
But, no. Okay, so here's the thing, Steve. You're too old to understand that reference. You're thinking about to tell the truth.
Correct.
And our young audience is thinking about Slim Shady.
Now,
it's an Eminem song. Will the real Slim Shady please stand up? It works, but this is one of those rare multi-generational references.
Nice. Well, then I'll keep that in my repertoire. Yeah. And I have discovered a new puzzle. And so far, I'm batting, 1,000 is good. 1,000 is perfect, as I understand it.
Well, I brought back Bleck for iPad today, yesterday, because it was such a great game, and I'm ready. Yeah. I'm ready for a new one. Let's do it.
Well, good, because that's the best named one I've come up with, or that I've seen. Yeah, I'm not a fan. I'll explain why.
Okay.
It's not my kind of thing. I like more of a sort of a strategy.
Something cerebral.
Yeah, thank you.
That was more of a kinetic puzzle. Yeah.
Lots to, and Bleck is, if nothing else, it's kinetic. So we have lots to talk about this week. And maybe if we have time, we will continue with some questions, because we were on a great roll there with those first four that we were that everyone liked last week.
They were awesome. Yeah.
We ran out of time. So we'll see. We'll play it by ear. Maybe we'll do some more Q&A if we have time.
Another great Security Now all queued up.
Lots of stuff.
Before we get going, let's remind you about our sponsor, FreshBooks. FreshBooks is a lifesaver if you're a freelancer. If you're in business for yourself, or you're a small business where you do your invoices, you know the end of the month is not the reason you got into business. On the other hand, you probably did get into business to get paid. Without the invoices, one doesn't get paid. So let's make it easy to do your invoices, to keep track, to have reports, to keep track of expenses. And FreshBooks fits the bill beautifully. And I know, because it saved my life. More than 10 years ago, when I first started using FreshBooks, I had put off billing, was owed a lot of money, never got that money. And finally, you know, it was Amber MacArthur. I got to give her credit, who told me about FreshBooks. She said, oh, there's a new company in Toronto. Got to try it. 5 million users later, FreshBooks is still the thing. And they're getting better and better all the time. FreshBooks, dead simple, cloud accounting. It makes it easy to do the invoices. It takes literally 30 seconds. They look great. You get paid faster because every invoice supports online payments. So your client can easily pay you back. And it turns out they want to do that. You can also do project deposits. This is something they've added recently. It lets you invoice for payment up front when you're kicking off the project. So you don't have to do it out of pocket. If a payee is late or a client is late, they automatically get, you know, a little reminder, ticklers and stuff, and they just do this all for you, and they do it in a way that's super effective. It's also fabulous because you get insight. For instance, you can tell, and I love this, whether a client has even seen your invoice. You'll know whether they've looked at that emailed invoice. So they can't say, oh, I didn't get it. Yes, you did, and you opened it at 10. You probably don't want to say that, but you'll know. This is a fraction of what FreshBooks can do for you. They have that chip card reader now, the EMV chip card, so they can swipe the stripe or dip the chip and then pay you. And that means if you do business in somebody's home, you can give with the FreshBooks app on your iPhone, you can present them with an estimate, present them with an invoice. They can pay you there. You go home. It's done. Get the paperwork out of the way. Get back to what you love to do with FreshBooks.com. By the way, when tax time comes, you'll love the reports. It makes it so much easier for you. Keep track of expenses, too, in the FreshBooks app. Time and hours, too. You know, on and on. Here's the thing. Try it. Free. 30 days. Go to FreshBooks.com/security now. FreshBooks.com/security now. And start your 30-day free trial. All I ask, there's a little form. And when they say, how did you hear about us? Just put security now. So Steve gets credit. FreshBooks.com/security now. I promise you it's going to make your life so much better. Back to Mr. G.
We did have a nice little bit of legislation coming out of the Congress.
I thought it was kind of telling. This Congress hasn't passed a bill unanimously in years.
No, and the fact that this was unanimous in the House, given how partisan the House is, this just says, what it means is it will just cruise through the Senate, because this thing goes from the House to the Senate. The Senate will say, fine, they'll bless it. And then it'll, be sent to the president for his signature. So this is the Email Privacy Act, which updates what was a 30-year-old law, the Electronic Communications Privacy Act, called the ECPA, of 1986. So, maybe needed a little bit of updating. What this does is requires the government to obtain a probable cause warrant from a judge before obtaining private communications and documents stored online with companies such as Google, Facebook, and Dropbox. The EFF supports this and was jumping up and down, and they were happy this passed. They did note, though, that one thing it did not do is require any notification by the government that this was being done to the user accounts where it was. So So this is still allows for secrecy, and the EFF considers that the notification is important because it would then allow users to obtain some legal counsel to lobby for their rights. So the EFF wasn't totally happy, but you know, this was a nice big step forward. And this also upheld it codified a previous appellate court, the Sixth Circuit Court's ruling that there was Fourth Amendment demands that the government first obtain a warrant before accessing emails stored in cloud service providers. So there had been some case law, but it hadn't been but that was just decided by a court attorneys arguing. Now it's been codified as, you know, formal doctrine. So this is nice and great to see this, as you said, Leo, unanimous is like, whoa, nobody said no. You know, so that's,
I think what it tells you, what it tells me is they're a little nervous about, because the whole thing was, you know, up to this point, actually, it's still the law. Anything older than 180 days is abandoned and doesn't need a warrant.
Right.
And I think that...
So half a year.
They realized, oh, crap, they're going to be able to read our email. There goes Dennis Hastert on his perp walk from old stuff. Maybe we better get some better protections for us. That's bad. I bet you. I mean, that's cynical of me, but I think that's...
That's a very good point, Leo. Very good point.
I mean, it's unanimous. So, it's got to be something like that, right?
Yeah. It was surprising.
Yeah.
But what it does mean is, unlike many of these things, I don't expect this to die. It's not going to die in the Senate. If it's unanimous in the House...
Oh, no, it'll go through. Yeah.
It'll just cruise right through.
They all have skeletons in their email. Every one of them.
And I see no reason why the president would not sign this into law. It's like, seems like a good thing. So, and, I mean, it keeps with this notion that the Constitution provides against overreach, where you have to convince a judge of that there's probable cause for search. And so, you know, this follows that model. Speaking of which, this was the argument that Fareed Zakaria had in his debate with Edward Snowden. There's something called the Debates of the Century series. And I perked up when I heard that some notable billionaires were funding this. And so there are a series of sort of high-end debates being held about significant questions. And they were debating, Fareed and Edward Snowden, who was there, of course, by telepresence. He was in Moscow. And Fareed is arguably my favorite CNN guy on Sundays. He has a Sunday show, GPS, Global Public Square. And I like his approach. It's sort of no nonsense. It's clean, maybe a little academic, but also, you know, grounded. So he debated with Edward Snowden the motion, quote, government should have lawful access to any encrypted message or device. That is, you know, they're debating the question as we call it on this podcast, DOD, decryption on demand. Should that be the way the law is? It's an interesting debate. Although I watched it this morning, and I didn't feel that we learned anything new. I was a little distraught by Snowden being a little cute. He's been the focus of this question for so long. He's developed some anecdotes. And from my standpoint, when I see somebody saying something that's important, which is arguably wrong, but is being stated as a fact, that's a problem. You know, I mean, opinions are fine, but facts are facts. Now, they did an online poll of the audience and their online viewers, because this was being streamed. I don't know how many, you know, how large the sample was. We didn't see a viewership number. But before the debate began, the moderator gave everybody a text message number where they could text how they feel. That is, government should have lawful access to any encrypted message or device. No, yes, or undecided. Before the debate, no was a little over three quarters, 77%. Yes was 13, and undecided was 10. After this hour-long discussion, no dropped to 69. So, and yes went up from 13 to 22, and undecided dropped a little bit, well, by 1% to 9%. So for what it's worth, Fareed made some good points. And Fareed's position, frankly, was my position, which is that he's had smart people tell him that this could be done if we wanted to do it. Edward Snowden's position was there's no possible way of it's just not possible, you know, and you know, he kept using things like outlawing encryption. And we know this is not about outlawing encryption. You know, government should have lawful access to any encrypted message or device is not about outlawing encryption. It's about putting in the law a means for providing access, which is different from outlawing encryption. So anyway, I made it the bit.ly link of the week for anyone who's interested. It was a good discussion, but there was nothing, you know, dramatically new brought forward. So at bit.ly/SN-558, if anyone wants, that just bounces you to the YouTube video. It's, I think, with the introductions, a little over an hour. And, you know, I enjoyed it, but, and, you know, these are the arguments that we've seen before. And, you know, the question of our era at the moment is where will the law come down? And, you know, there were some interesting points made. So, but again, nothing earth-shattering. And we still have this fingerprint compulsion question like in the wind. Actually, all of these things are still up in the air. Even can you be compelled to give testimony against yourself in the form of your passcode if you're not using biometrics? This was brought back into the news because an LA judge or court ruled that the girlfriend of an alleged Armenian gang member had to press her finger against an iPhone, which had been seized from a home in Glendale, where it was believed that this iPhone would contain important evidence in the case. So, you know, as we know, we've talked about this before, this whole question of is a biometric, because it's something you are, not something you know. The argument has been that it doesn't qualify as testimony. And so what the Constitution protects is self-incriminating testimony. And so there have been arguments that compelling someone to release a passcode is requiring them to testify against their interests. Well, there are scholars that believe that that argument can be extended to unlocking a phone. That if a phone contains incriminating evidence, then even though it's sort of one step removed, the same law applies. So the Supreme Court has ruled at the Supreme Court level that police can search your phone if they have a warrant, and separately that they can order you to produce fingerprints without a court order. However, it's not clear that the two can be combined. So what we're still doing here is we're sort of rummaging around in the lower courts, very much like, you know, Apple and the FBI were, needing the highest court to formalize law that works for, you know, 2016 and going forward. We talked about 2 years ago in 2014, that case in Virginia that set some precedent, which determined that fingerprints were okay to compel, but passcodes were not. At the same time, it's not decided. At the moment, there is a 17-year veteran and former sergeant of the Philadelphia Police Department who is suspected of, but not formally charged with, possession of child abuse images on encrypted hard drives. He is in contempt of court because he has refused to provide the passphrase that would unlock those drives. So although he's not even formally charged, because he refuses to provide those passphrases, he's been in jail for 7 months. And the judge says he will remain locked up indefinitely until he decrypts the drive, saying that, quote, he carries the keys to his prison in his own pocket. So here again, we have the same sort of problem. Is we've got competing interests and attorneys arguing their sides of these cases, and every court decides, you know, what it wants to based on some precedent or ignoring precedent. And meanwhile, we need the Supreme Court to decide these issues. But at this point, it's not clear. There's a woman, Mary Fan, who's a law professor at the University of Washington, who was asked by Ars Technica on this issue. And she said, this is why I tell my criminal procedure students that they have more protections today if they use a passcode rather than a fingerprint to guard entry to their phones. While I don't, she said, conduct crimes on my cell phone, I still decline to use my fingerprint out of an abundance of caution. And of course, I also don't conduct crimes on my iPhone, and I use my fingerprint out of an abundance of convenience.
I think what's interesting, I mean, we've always said this, that, you know, they can collect a fingerprint, they can collect hair. But I understand why this is now, and it should be going to court and ultimately should be decided by Congress, as with all of these things, because a fingerprint is like giving a piece of evidence, or hair is a piece of evidence. It's not testifying against yourself. But unlocking your phone is more than a piece of evidence. It's giving
an action.
It's an action that gives a much larger pool of information to law enforcement. So I understand why this is actually being contested.
Yeah.
And I do hope that they will see this as more than simply giving up a fingerprint or giving a DNA sample.
A fingerprint traditionally has been limited to identifying you.
Right.
That is, you know, is that your fingerprint?
It's a piece of evidence, but not self-testimony. Right.
Right.
It's, you know, again, as the president said, we are fetishizing our phones, but there's a good reason for it. They have everything. They've got it all.
Well, and I would argue that privacy needs to be, you know, pried from our cold, dead hands. That is, you know, let's fight for all of it that we can get, and we'll see how much we can hold on to. My guess is, it's not going to be something that we can have absolutely. And of course, we know on this podcast that there's no such thing. You know, the phrase electronic internet privacy is an oxymoron, because, you know, there's one portion of the ecosystem is unlocked, but all of the conduits in and out can be spied on. So, okay. You know, there is an aspect of this that isn't as absolute as we would like to imagine that it actually is.
It'll be very interesting to see
this
whole thing play out. I think we're going to see it play out. And it may end up being a small footnote to the presidential election, which is actually playing out right now. It made me moot, in other words.
I meant to talk to you about this.
Well, we don't want to get political on the show. Yet many of the subjects that come up in covering technology are political. This is a perfect example.
Yeah.
It affects us.
It's never been clear to me how this really divides down party lines. And we might argue that the unanimous vote for email privacy hasn't. You know, things like Hillary's email, that's clearly political realm stuff. I went on record months ago saying if there was actually an operating server in a closet in some random office building, then if you don't have physical security, you have no security. So that was unconscionable. I have, you know, just to get to my servers where there's like not that much of great import, I've got to go through three different hoops, you know, and guarded camera scanning, dogs are sniffing around. I mean, it's intimidating, you know. And then we hear that, you know, that the server was in operation in a closet off of the bathroom. It's like, what?
Well, but I think that's a larger story, because I think that's more a reaction to the fact that the government didn't have secure servers. And so, you know.
And wasn't really enforcing policy.
Yeah.
They say they had policy.
It's because email's so new, frankly. And so, I'm sure by now, I would hope that they have. But these governmental email servers were not any more secure than one in your closet.
No.
So, in fact, perhaps less so because they were a target. So, I mean, I can't impute her intention, but you could make the case that she felt it was more secure to run her own server than it would be to trust the government servers.
Well, and we've talked about this before, but the fact that her email address wasn't .gov,
right.
It was .bill or something.
It was Clinton, you know? Email. ClintonEmail.com.
Or something,
yeah.
You know.
Yeah. She was using her personal email for government business. But again, that's because this was all new and still is somewhat new. And government moves slowly. Remember, we've had email for a long time. They're just now figuring out that if you don't use your email for six months, it's not abandoned. You know,
right. I mean, and Colin Powell did the same thing.
He did the same thing, exactly, because it was new.
You know, so this was, you know, this hadn't been addressed, and certainly
right.
It has been over-addressed now.
Yeah,
but anyway, my point was that clearly that is a political issue that I have
partisan.
A feeling we're going to be
right.
living with until November. But, so you know, this, to me, seems apolitical. It seems, I mean, I don't see where this is partisan, but this is policy, and you know, incredibly intriguing. You know, I've got a bunch of projects on hold.
Yeah, no, I got to watch and see what happens. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So Android is back in the news, but in the same way that, you know, all of our deeply inspected platforms now are. What we're seeing is, you know, if there's a takeaway sort of with a broad brush, it would have to be if you look really, really, really hard at anything that's really complicated, you will find holes. We see it over and over and over. I just read, and I didn't have a chance to dig it up because it just came by an hour ago, that OpenSSL just had two long-standing critical patches made. You know, there it is. It's everywhere. It's long-standing. They're like really big problems with it. Yeah, and it's like, okay, yeah, and we just fixed two real big problems that presumably everybody needs to fix OpenSSL now. And, you know, and so we have a history of problems with Windows. Now, you know, Android is the new kid on the block. As I mentioned at the top of the show, what Google is calling the Nexus Security Bulletin has been renamed the Android Security Bulletin yesterday. And nothing huge to mention. They did push out an over-the-air update containing 32 vulnerabilities. The carriers received this package a month ago on April 4th. So with any luck, they've been pushing those out too. There were two privately disclosed. So these are not zero day. They are not known to be currently exploited, but once again, in the media server module, two critical remote code execution vulnerabilities, which affect versions 4.4.4, 5.0.2, 5.1.1, 6.0, and 6.0.1. And these those are all in the show notes for anyone who's interested. The problem is that Media Server is very exposed. In one podcast some months ago, we really took a close look. We were looking at the C code and looking at the pointer math where it was so easy. They hadn't casted this same variable the same way. So this is the problem with C is that it's very literal, as programming languages are. And because there was a slight mix-up in the interpretation of the variable, the inequality was treated as signed or unsigned or a different length. I don't remember the exact detail, but we covered it at the time. So what's happening is now people are looking carefully at this and finding more problems. But the crux of it is that it's this shared media processing library that needs to handle a wide range of different input file types and formats. And the so-called stage fright vulnerability or this media server module is accessible in a number of different ways. And what we've also seen is that media parsers have historically been problematical. You know, parsers in general tend to be kind of an inflection point. We see them, for example, with font rendering. That's a font format parser where it's essentially taking sort of a meta language and interpreting it to understand the exact handling of the media that it's bringing along, whether it's a font or it's a graphics file, or in the case of Media Server, MMS or MPEG movies or whatever. So it's just it's a difficult type of code to get right, and as we know, it's necessary to be perfect, because if it's not perfect, then and it's possible for an exploit to find its way to the flaw, then that can be leveraged. And the problem is that many different components within the Android OS invoke this media server module sort of by implication. It's just there to handle their media needs. And so there are all kinds of, so what that means is it has a large attack surface, and there are just all kinds of ways to get externally supplied sort of pseudo media at this module. And if it's not perfect, that can cause problems. I'm hoping that Google will get this out to everyone with Nexus devices. If you have an option, you certainly want to update. I know that Amazon is, I've got a Fire device, and it's every time I turn on, there's like it's been doing things. So I'm assuming that these updates are getting out in a timely fashion. And again, not super critical. It's not like it was before, where this was a zero day and it was already being exploited in the wild and people's phones were getting taken over. But this is just something you want to get taken care of, and probably we haven't seen the last of it. It's I forgot to mention that this server is operating with extensive rights on the platform. For you know, it needs to have access to the camera and the microphone and lots of the platform's hardware. So it's in a privileged position, and unfortunately, it's prone to being poked at. I tweeted earlier today that we now know that the Portuguese abbreviation PQP is our equivalent of WTF. Because there are a lot of people.
I want to hear you tweeting. Say it in Portuguese.
Oh, and speaking of which, I am, from now on, I am spelling Australian city names. Talking about, you know, batting 1,000 with puzzles, I'm at
impossible.
Zero.
I know.
For I'm not doing it anymore. I'm going to spell them because I just have no idea how to pronounce them. I can't do it. So, once again, a judge yesterday ordered a 3-day blackout of WhatsApp in Brazil because WhatsApp, of course, now owned by Facebook and now sporting the Signal messaging protocol, which is designed so that it cannot be decrypted. And given the way it's structured, we covered it extensively. It's just it's a beautiful protocol. Hats off to Moxie and group for producing Signal and for WhatsApp and Facebook for incorporating it in. So, you know, this judge is the same guy who a few months ago not only ordered WhatsApp to be blacked out, but put a WhatsApp executive in jail briefly. And so he's just on the warpath. He just doesn't get this, that, you know, this has been designed so that it's not possible. And they say it's not possible. And so then the fine would be the equivalent of $142,000 to a carrier, a cell phone carrier, who did not comply with the judge's order. So throughout Brazil, WhatsApp was blocked and it went dark. Then the order was once again overturned. The executive, a couple months ago, he was let out of prison. You know, and people were just scratching their heads, saying, "Well, we don't know what's wrong with this judge." But you know, sorry about that, sir. So again, we're seeing the consequence of this weird place we're in, where we are currently designing encryption that no one is able to decrypt. And the courts haven't caught up with that. So, and I don't know what'll happen. I mean, we're having a big enough problem in the U.S. where we're watching this all happen. But, you know, there's Brazil. And then there was, what was the country, do you remember, that was going to outlaw completely, ban all encryption?
Oh, yeah. I don't remember. It was a former East Soviet bloc country.
Yeah, I don't remember now. But they're just going to, you know.
It was Hungary. Hungary.
Yes, you're right. Hungarian. Yes.
But obviously, no. This is going to be a battle that's going to be held all over the world.
Yep.
And see, my answer to the Fareed Zakaria Snowden debate is that's posing kind of the wrong question. I would agree that lawful interception of encryption would be nice. However, it's just not available because anytime you do that, you undermine encryption. And so people who want to – and good encryption exists. It'd be very – I mean, if countries try to really outlaw strong encryption, which is the only –
Well, the argument – the best argument is that, as we know, strong encryption apps exist.
There's nothing
so
you could do about
if
it.
Even if Apple was compelled to redesign their system – so that the iPhones could be unlocked on demand without any weakening, well, doesn't matter. Because, you know, Al Jazeera, not Al Jazeera, ISIS already has their own.
Right. Well, I do too. And so do you. Everybody does. So, and WhatsApp has kind of jumped the game by building it into their app as well. So everybody has access to that. So then what do you do? The only next logical step is to ban use of strong encryption. Which, by the way, would also, somebody pointed out, the Burr Feinstein would also ban the use of a browser since it has built-in strong encryption, and the guy who makes the browser cannot break it, or will stop using browsers because they'll do a man in the middle, right? And at that point, then the only thing you could do is ban strong encryption. And when that happens, well, I fear for the world because what are you going to put everybody in jail who uses BGP?
Yeah.
I don't know how
we're
going to play out.
Answer the question, BitCon or not. Why don't we take a break, and then we'll turn our attention to who Indeed. Is Satoshi, and do we know?
I'm excited about it. This is a good one. I'm looking forward to this one. Our show today brought to you by great folks who we've talked about in the past, Thinkst, T-H-I-N-K-S-T. They do Canary. Every day, you know, on this show every week, we talk about high-profile breaches like Sony and the Office of Personnel Management and Target. Some of those companies, probably all of them, had million-dollar IT budgets, million-dollar security budgets, but they had one problem. They didn't know they were compromised. Sony went 9 months with bad guys wandering their system at will without any knowledge. If only they'd had a canary. Canary is a really clever idea. You sprinkle a few canaries on your network, make one a router, one a Windows file share, and you just wait. Attackers and malicious insiders say, ooh, there's a little pot of gold over there, and they make their presence known because they talk to the canary, and you get a high-quality alert. One alert lets you know, hey, there's somebody in your canary. You can set them up fast, too. They're easy. They're appliances. Just a few minutes of configuration, it's going to look identical to a router or a switch or a NAS server or a Linux box or a Windows server. Attackers won't know the difference. They don't look vulnerable. Actually, this is kind of an interesting thought. They look valuable. You could put fake, you know, assets on them. You can enroll them in Active Directory. And the nice thing is you're not going to get 100 alerts a day. You're not going to get weird stuff. It's not going to add to the noise. Just one high-quality alert when it matters. Thinkst. They've been doing this for 2 decades. They've trained countless companies, militaries, governments on how to break into networks. And that's why they were inspired to build the Canary. Instead of massive upfront cost, your Canary is licensed annually. If birds, as we call them, if your birds break during the year, Thinkst comes in, just gives you a new one. The pricing also allows you to easily try a few, then scale up as you want. There are shops with 2 canaries. There are banks with hundreds. Thinkst canaries are being used all over the world, from Iceland to Australia. Many of the biggest names in Silicon Valley run them. They won't tell you who, because that's the whole point. No one knows, do they? So, by the way, by using Thinkst canaries, these companies are helping everybody. Because now the bad guys don't know. Is this safe? Are we being watched? Check it out. Canary.tools/twit. You can get more information. See them in action. They're $7,500 per year. That's the license fee for 5 canaries. You also get your own hosted console, your upgrades, support, and maintenance for a full year. We're going to get you some savings, though, if you visit canary.tools/twit and enter the code TWIT in the How Did You Hear About Us box. You get 10% off your canaries for life. Canary.tools/twit. We know you're going to love them. And, of course, if you're not happy, you can return your canaries. You have 2 months for a full money-back guarantee. So what's the harm in trying it? Canary.tools/twit. This will be the one appliance on your network you hope you never hear from. But when you do, you'll know. You'll be glad you did. 10% off if you use the offer code TWIT. Leo Laporte, Steve Gibson, talking security and moving on.
So we're back again to who is the creator of the Bitcoin. And back in December, so what, like five and a half months ago, this other person came to the fore. Craig Wright, W-R-I-G-H-T. Two publications were, you know, claiming that he was the guy. We talked about it a little bit at the time. I didn't give it much time on the podcast.
It had broken during the show.
Ah.
Which is why. So you didn't have time to really think about it. And by the time we were back next week, it was like, yeah, that's bogus.
Well, and his location was raided.
The day that it was broken, and it was broken in Gizmodo and Wired magazine,
yep.
And it was suspect from the beginning. And that day, he was raided by Australian tax authorities.
Right, right. So, we just let it drop. Okay, then suddenly there's this big flurry a couple days ago. And I mean, because Bitcoin is a big thing, it's an opportunity for everyone on the internet to say something about, you know, who is this? Anyway, my tweet from this morning, Craig Wright put up a second tweet this morning.
Well, we should say that this started up again because the BBC and The Economist.
Yes.
BBC said, oh, we found him. This is for sure true. The Economist hedged it a little bit. In both cases, they were partially convinced by the former director of the Bitcoin Foundation, a man I've interviewed on Triangulation, Gavin Andresen, who is a smart and one thinks, one trusts a guy with integrity, and one of the few people who's personally corresponded with Nakamoto. He took over the Bitcoin Foundation when Nakamoto withdrew from the internet in 2011. He said to Andresen, okay, you're in charge. I'll see you. See ya. So if anybody, you'd think Gavin would be the guy to ask. And he met with Wright, flew to meet with Wright to see the proofs, the demonstrations of the proofs, and wrote on his blog, well, this is it. If I thought before I met with him, it would be true, and it is. And of course, immediately his commit keys were withdrawn from GitHub from the Bitcoin repository because people thought either he was hacked or he's delusional. We still don't know. I don't think Gavin's said anything much since then.
So, okay. So, thank you for the background.
So people know where we stand.
So there was a first post a couple days ago, which it sort of felt like a shell game. I mean, very much like, you know, like Craig, who is so this Craig Wright guy who is claiming to be Satoshi. He says in his first post, I really sort of reluctantly have decided that I need to assert proof that I'm Satoshi because I was hoping this would all blow over back in December, and it kind of did, but then again it kind of didn't, and my friends and family and acquaintances are being harassed, and it's like, okay, you know, either you are or you're not.
And meanwhile, he's benefited significantly from the perception that he is Satoshi.
Right. And the problem is that, as we know from our podcast on Bitcoin years ago, that what there is ultimately is a private key, and that private key is used to sign things. And we talk about this sort of concept in crypto on the podcast all the time. And that if he purchased, if he spent a Bitcoin that he mined, and what we believe is that he's got a million Bitcoins that are now worth $449.
The real Satoshi does.
Correct. Satoshi. Yeah, right. We believe that the originator of the blockchain has – I mean, no, we know that there are a million Bitcoins presumably created by and owned by and being held by the real Satoshi. And all that's necessary is that if Satoshi wants to prove his identity – He can
move a Bitcoin from the known Satoshi blocks.
Yes.
But pre-announce it. Say, I, Dr. Craig Watson, am now going to move a coin from the Satoshi block. That would be sufficient, right?
Correct.
Because unless he's stolen
his keys. The only way to do that is with the private key in the Bitcoin wallet.
Right.
This evidence, unquote, that was shown wasn't that. It was some sort of obscure use of scripts and kind of, again, I liken it to a shell game.
It was a magic trick. It was BS.
Yeah, where sort of some things were shown and some hashes were made and, you know, don't look behind the curtain and, oh, look, these hashes are identical. Now, a number of people have torn that apart. Then this morning, Craig posted again. And so I read, as I was preparing for the podcast, this latest blog posting of his that I'm going to share. Because what I tweeted was, I sure hope this clown is not Satoshi. Get a load of this latest spew of nonsense. So, okay, so, and I mean, I'll let people draw their own conclusions. But so he says it was the posting was titled "Extraordinary Claims Require Extraordinary Proof." And people have had a lot of fun with that already because it's like, no, just proof.
Any proof. Real proof.
Just real, exactly, real proof. Not extraordinary, just actual. So he says, yesterday, Andreas Antonopoulos posted a fantastic piece on Reddit. And this is Craig speaking in his blog post this morning. Andreas said something critically important, and it bears repeating, quote, "I think the identity of Satoshi Nakamoto does not matter." And then Craig continues, "He's absolutely right. It doesn't and shouldn't matter to the Bitcoin community. I cannot deny," writes Craig, "that my interest in bringing the origins of Bitcoin into the light, is ultimately and undeniably a selfish one. The only person to whom this should matter is me. In the wake of the articles last December in which I was outed, I still believe that I could remain silent. I still believed that I could retreat into anonymity, sever contact, go quiet, and that the storm would eventually pass and life would return to normal. I was right and wrong. The story did eventually retreat, but not before it turned, and the allegations of fraud and hoax, not to mention personal threats and slurs against me and my family, clung to me. I now know that I can never go back, so I must go through and go forward." Mr. Antonopoulos' post also notes that if Satoshi wants to prove identity, quote, "they don't need an authority to do so. They can do it in a public, open manner." This, again, writes Craig, is absolutely true, but not necessarily complete. I can prove access to the early keys, and I can and will do so by moving Bitcoin. But this should be a necessary but not sufficient condition for such an extraordinary claim.
What?
Anyway, and this is why I wanted to speak with Gavin weeks ago. Gavin was in a unique position as we dealt with each other directly while we nurtured Bitcoin to life in 2010. I knew that Gavin would remember the content of those messages and discussions and would recall our arguments and early interactions. I wanted to speak with Gavin first, not to appeal to his authority, but because I wanted him to know. I owed him that. It was important to me that we could reestablish our relationship. Simply signing messages or moving Bitcoin would never be enough for Gavin. Okay, I don't know what any of that means. He says, and it should not be enough for anyone else. No, sorry. It's just spend some Bitcoin. Anyway, so he finally says, so over the coming days, I will be posting a series of pieces that will lay the foundations for this extraordinary claim.
This really sounds like a con artist.
Doesn't it? It does.
Stroking Gavin, because yes. Gavin, you know, is the mark. And it just really feels like that kind of
laying
con.
The foundation. I'll be posting a series of pieces.
Grandiose, narcissistic.
That lay the foundations for this extraordinary claim, which will include posting independently verifiable documents and evidence.
No, just stop talking and do it, right?
Exactly.
Just do it.
And addressing some of the false allegations that have been leveled and transferring Bitcoin from an early block. Mm-hmm. For some, there is no burden of proof high enough. Swooning. No evidence that cannot be dismissed as fabrication or manipulation. This is the nature of belief, and swimming against this current would be futile. You should be skeptical. You should question. I would. I will present what I believe to be extraordinary proof and ask only that it be independently validated. Ultimately, I can do no more than that. It's like, oh my Lord.
It's BS. Anyway, so it's just blatant BS. It's obvious.
It is. Now you understand why my tweet was, I sure hope this clown is not Satoshi. Get a load of this latest spew of nonsense.
Yeah.
Robert Graham followed up with a very nice cryptographic deconstruction titled How Craig Wright's Deception Worked, where he basically takes apart what was done a few days ago, and no one understood a few days ago why he just didn't do it. And we're still waiting. I mean, we don't know until, you know, we don't know what's going to come next. But he says
I love it that he posts screenshots of the proof.
Yes.
With typos, by the way. the bash commands that he uses wouldn't actually run.
Oh.
If you typed them in. So this is very common kind of con artist behavior. And it's sad because I feel that Gavin's been taken in by it. But
well, Craig should just dig a hole and crawl in it and stop doing anything. Because
if you wonder what's in it for him, he has left Australia. He's in a flight there because he owes a lot of money to the tax authorities, because what he was doing was using Bitcoin to generate tax refunds and collecting actual cash for Bitcoin transactions. And by the way, if you're Satoshi, you don't really need to do this because you've got $100 million in Bitcoin. So he would do he did a $30 million Bitcoin transaction and ask for a tax refund. The tax refund's in real Australian dollars, so he'd get the check. That's why he was under investigation. They want his money back, so he left the country.
Why he's in London?
Yeah. It's obvious what's going on.
Yeah.
It's sad. And, you know, Gavin Andresen has not published anything since his original confirmation. There's some question in my mind. Maybe he was compromised. Where is he? What is his response? Or maybe he's just embarrassed. Because, you know, if you've been conned, what you want to do is really. You double down on it.
You want exoneration.
Yeah. You don't want to admit that you were fooled.
Yeah.
So it's sad.
So for our listeners, we still don't know. But, you know, John McAfee's been a little quiet lately, so we have some more entertainment. Wow. I did want to follow up on something that we talked about last week. David Roots sent me a DM, and he said, in the latest Security Now episode, you and Leo agreed that turning off the computer adds no real security. He says that's not the case when we're talking of a home computer, which is in a safe environment like your house. However, I work in a bank. My workstation stays in the office after I leave for the day. I always turn it off each day, even though it adds a minute of boot time for tomorrow. The reasons are as follows. I do not know who has physical access to the PC when I'm gone. I've set BIOS passwords for boot and admin, which should at least make it more difficult to boot the OS or from USB. I've encrypted my hard drive, which has to be unlocked before boot. I have no real faith in the Ubuntu lock screen. It's nice that he's using Ubuntu. There are ways to bypass it. When shut off, there is nothing in the RAM. No loaded SSH keys, no login passwords, etc. So I wanted to tack that on to the end of our discussion, because I thought that was a good point. You know, we leave our machines on because it's better for them to stay on. They're not thermally cycling, going hot and cold and hot and cold. Once upon a time, ICs used to creep out of their sockets but when integrated circuits were in sockets. They're not in sockets anymore. And Lord knows the CPU cannot possibly get loose from where it's contained because it's screwed down tight against its socket. But still, it's just not good if you don't need to, I would argue, to power cycle a machine that doesn't need to be. But David makes a great point. If you don't have oversight over the machine for the two-thirds of its life that it's not that you're not sitting in front of it, definitely better to turn it off. And if it's the bank's computer, presumably they're keeping it current and backed up. And if it does have a problem, they'll get you another one. So no biggie.
It also saves power.
Yes. Very good point.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, errata. I stepped in it last week.
Oh, I'm sorry. I usually try to protect you from those things. What happened? I feel bad. I feel like it's my fault.
Well, on this podcast, I endorsed something that I myself could not physically bring myself to do. And I did it without thinking. So I apologize. I endorsed the idea of piping the output from curl into bash in order to set up an open VPN server on the Raspberry Pi. And what I loved was the first of a tweet storm that I received from our very security conscious, absolutely correct listeners was from a Patty Curley, who he tweeted, "Really, Steve? Pipe this random script from a guy called Infection to install something? What happened to TNO?" And so everybody who sent this is, of course, correct. I mean, if I were sitting there, I wouldn't be physically capable of entering that command because I would run, you know, I would pull the contents of the URL into a file and look at it. I would, out of curiosity, and because I would I would implicitly understand that I'm pulling a script off of the internet and it's running, you know, it's essentially providing a stream of commands to the bash command prompt doing who knows what. Now, at the same time, it is time for reality check because, you know, I did find out, by the way, that Infection is 40 years old and has kids. So, you know,
his old handle. He's not Infection anymore.
Yeah.
Now he's Dad.
Yeah. So at the same time, let's all remember the degree of implicit trust that we have in everything we do. Unless you design the chip and, you know, and bring the sand in from the beach and make it and program it and build it up from its roots, there at every single stage, we're trusting the goodwill of the people that provided this to us. And there have been lots of accusations of like secret things in some of the early Intel chips, you know, things that we weren't, you know, things were undocumented and we weren't sure about. And of course, there's that famous NSA key in Windows. That thing, that rumor never goes away because it happens. There's some coincidental string that happens to be NSA that people keep finding inside of Windows. It's like, no. The NSA does not have master keys, you know, to Windows. I mean, so I want to acknowledge and thank everybody.
The point kind of is that trust no one is an impossible goal. It's a good motto, and it's a good thing to aim for. But you can't compute without trusting a lot of people.
Well,
right?
And even in the trust no one model, which is, for example, you encrypt something locally and then you stick it on the cloud.
Right.
The point being, you pre-encrypt it.
Right.
And we were calling it PIE for a while, pre-internet encryption. Even there, you know, unless you wrote the crypto yourself, You are trusting the authors of the crypto.
Right.
So all of these things have a security perimeter. Now,
what was it that we were piping?
It's very cool.
You
connect a Raspberry Pi to your router. You bring up the command shell on the Raspberry Pi, and you type in one line, which is a curl. You know, curl retrieves a URL from the internet, and then avert the vertical pipe character and bash. So you're basically piping
a script into bash.
Into bash.
Which is no different than downloading the script and then invoking it. It's just saves
well, and
a step.
That's exactly right. You could download an executable and that performed all the same configuration stuff. So what I liked was the elegance of the minimalism of that. But with it comes some responsibility that we are trusting the integrity and the intentions of the person who did this. Now, I will say that something that, for example, did this hourly or daily, that would raise my alarms higher, because then at any time in the future, if there was a compromise, like imagine the world is full of these Raspberry Pis that are doing this every day. Well, then that's a huge target of opportunity. Somebody compromises that script once, and suddenly all these devices download something nefarious. To me, you know, it's different if you get it once. And by all means, you know, look over the script.
Well, is it a bash script that you're downloading? Because if it is, you can just look. It's open source. Code's open.
It's a text file.
Look at it, but then probably download it once, look at it, and run it in a cron job instead of running the curl command each time in the cron job. But
it doesn't have to be run each time. It only is once.
But we all do this all the time. Have you ever downloaded some code from Git and compiled it and run it? That's essentially the same thing. And it behooves you to trust the person you got it from. And the nice thing is, if it's a script, you can read it.
Right.
So you can, by the way, this brings up a point, because over the past week, a number of people have sent me scripts for downloading every Security Now episode. And I've posted those scripts on my blog, leolaporte.com. And I said in the post, I haven't run them, and a cursory glance looks like they're not malicious. But if you want to use these, you know, it's on your head. So there's a bash script from Seth Leedy. There's a Python script from the Punk Geek. And Gary Neville sent me a PowerShell script for you Windows 10 users that will either download individual episodes of Security Now or all the episodes if you want, or other episodes of other shows as well. So those are at leolaporte.com. And you know what? It's the same thing.
However, want to acknowledge
not the, named infection.
The people who said, "Wait a minute," and I should have said something. I didn't say anything last week, so that's why this is in errata. I should have said I wouldn't type that. I mean, I would obtain the script
and
I would, out of curiosity, if nothing else, just peruse it to see what it's doing and decide, okay, and then, you know, send it in to bash to set up the VPN. And by the way, it works. I've had several tweets from people who said, oh my God, I have my Raspberry Pi is now an open VPN server running, you know, plugged into my router, and I can to my home network.
That's
beautifully. So congratulations to Infection, a proud father, not a teen.
He wrote a script that does everything you would do manually.
Yes.
Automatedly. You can review it. And you know what? That's a hell of a lot safer than a binary blob that you have no idea what it's doing. So
good point.
You know, I don't have a problem with that. Read it before you curl it. I mean, curl it, read it, then bash it.
Right. Okay. So, Leo, if you scroll down, you'll find a GIF or YIF or
a GIF. We're going to call it YIFs from now on.
No, please, not a YIF. it's blogspot.com. Click that. so you can show that. That's an animated GIF. I've always called them GIFs, so I'm going with GIF.
Yeah, me too.
An animated, or was it GIF? Now I've even forgot what I used to call it.
I've doing both to drive people crazy.
Yeah. Actually, what okay, so I have a new puzzle. I tweeted it when I discovered it, and I owe someone of our listeners a thanks, because this is one that I had already obtained, and it was sitting on my device, and I just hadn't gotten around to it yet.
Oh, I like this. This looks good.
Oh, Leo, it is wonderful. Now, we had Rails in the past, which was the choo-choo train track thing that was fun.
Yeah.
Blockwick, a lot of people loved. That was a really nice, sort of satisfying sliding block puzzle. Hook, of course, was very popular. Mm-hmm. The only problem with it, there was only like 25 levels. And I contacted the author and I said, everybody wants more. And he said, no, I'm going to do something different. Well, okay. I said, if you ever need more money, just do more levels and we want more. Then, of course, there was Osmos and Auralux, which are sort of similar and both wonderful. And then Infinite Loop. Infinite Loop probably is the most favorite of the puzzles I have recommended, because it's more of sort of a doodle. You know, it doesn't take much thought. You just, you know, tap it and it rotates pieces in order to like knit this thing into a finished little puzzle. And it's infinite. So after the disappointment of discovering that Hook only had 25 levels, we really wanted something that we wouldn't run out of. Okay, this one is a win. It's called The Sequence. And I created some jump links. The first 13 levels are available free on the Android platform. So
it's only 99 cents. I'm buying it for the whole thing, right?
Yes, Leo. Absolutely.
I trust you,
must.
Steve. It's worth a buck.
I tweeted it maybe like 5 days ago, and people already know that they're in trouble when I recommend a puzzle.
By the way, it's also not only available on Android but also iOS and Steam,
correct?
And Windows. So
correct.
You'll have a platform you can play this on.
Yes, it is the grand prize winner of the Unity Game Developer Contest. Man. Unity is a cross-platform development environment, and these guys took first grand prize. This is different than the other things. The person who recommended it to me said, Steve, you like programming, you'll probably like this. First of all, the developer is gifted. There's sort of a whimsicalness to it. It's not only is it a great concept, but it is beautifully done. So after I tweeted, I got a reply back from Pete Shanahan, who said, at SGGRC, you are the only person whose game recommendations get immediately purchased / downloaded. You have stellar taste, sir. And so I wrote back. I said, I DM'd him back. I said, thank you, Pete. Because people have figured out that I love puzzles, I get lots of recommendations, but only a few make it through my own filter. So I'm always excited to share those that do. My criteria are clear. No hurry, no timers, no reflexes being tested, no unnecessary punishment, underdesigned, not overdesigned, no hidden stuff that you need to poke at to find. Just the kind of thing where everything you need to know is in front of you so that you can stare at the screen running possibilities through your mind. This one goes a bit further and is actually charming and humorous in its execution. I think people who have enjoyed my previous discoveries will find this one equally wonderful. Thanks again. So, The Sequence. And as you said, Leo, it's available on all platforms. It is, and the first 13 levels free on Android. I just love it. So to give people who are just listening to this some idea, you have a grid of, that is like 7 by 9, something like that. It's an odd by odd so that you have a center column and center row. Not that that's important, but I just noticed that. And there is a there's one cell where there is a binary object. It's a little white circle. And that's the sort of the source. And then there's another sink where you need to transfer this binary circle over from the source to the sink. And you have little modules. For example, there's a module which is a pusher. And so anything that is in front of it, it pushes to the next square. But it can't push it further than that because then it's not in front of it any longer. Then there's something else that grabs it and rotates it 90 degrees into a square off to the side. And then there's another thing which spins whatever is in front of it. And then there's another thing that reverses the polarity of the thing that it's connected to. So like it would cause it the next spin to be in the other direction, or it turns the pusher into a puller. Anyway, the point is for just I'm at like level 25 or something, and there's five objects that have been, and this is sort of selectively revealed to you. A little tutorial in the beginning gets the hang of it, and then you're off. And so this is something not to be upset about, that some of these are difficult. This is not so much a doodler as it is a real problem solver. But boy, I just think people who are hooked by this are going to enjoy being hooked because it is fun. The soundtrack is nice, but a little repetitive in the background. But the actual sounds of the actions are fun. And after you think you get it arranged, you start it. And then this whole thing sort of runs in a stepwise fashion because you assign a sequence to each of these little blocks. And so they execute one at a time, and their actions then all link together in order to move this little binary bit thing from the source to the sink. And it has to do it four times in order for you to succeed on the level. And you'll sort of get the hang of it when you see it. But anyway, I have no reservations, except that I will say it's a little tougher. It's some of these things, I have no problem putting them down and then coming back to them a few hours later or the next day and going, okay. And oftentimes I have an inspiration. So some of them are tricky, but I really think people who enjoy the podcast.
Yeah, it's programming. It really is.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. It's a little graphical programming language. I should mention, too, just so that I haven't omitted it, that the same author has a previous game called Hard Logic. And that's in the offing. I've poked at it a little bit, and it's like, oh, it was well named. It is even more minimal, but it does look like but I'm just loving this. Oh, and after you get the 32nd level, I think it's 32, maybe it's 35. Anyway, then it unlocks a playground. And I think what that means is you could just build your own machines.
Oh, neat.
Which, yeah, I think would really be fun. They're one, I don't know what it is about it, but the execution is just beautiful. The graphics, the little noises they make, I just get a kick out of watching the thing go, and you feel a real sense of accomplishment when you've built one of these, because as I said, they do get challenging.
Cool.
Yeah. I wanted to mention that KB3035583 resurfaced. When I turned my machine on this morning, my Windows 7 machine, and of course, 3035583, you got to be a real geek to know what that number means. That's the infamous WGX, the Get Windows 10.
GWX, although
yeah, sorry,
you might be GWX. Tempted to call it WTF. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, why are they changing it? I don't know why. I bit the bullet because I have to make sure they haven't done something really stupid. Maybe they're backing off. Oh, Leo, we forgot to talk about the weather lady.
Well, we did it on Windows Weekly last week. Lady. So, yeah, but that is proof positive that Microsoft has gone too far.
Oh, boy. For anyone who's been living under a rock, you probably already know. But during a morning, and was it last Wednesday? It's been since the last podcast.
But Microsoft recommends upgrade to Windows 10.
There it is.
What should I do? Don't you love when that pops up, huh? Anyway, over an inch has fallen across southwest Iowa, and we'll be keeping track of that as the morning goes.
The best is the last line, though, here.
Yes, I know.
What's going on with my clicker now? Okay, the winds have been very gusty overnight as well. It's the Windows 10, right? That's what people are going to say. Don't do it.
Don't do it.
So she's doing, you know, she is a meteorologist standing in front of the green screen, and up comes the big, we all know what it looks like, the big white and blue, you know, Microsoft recommends updating to Windows 10. Oh, and it's like, oh boy. Wow.
Oh,
enough
Lord.
Said. Oh, yeah. So, and of course, you know, I got a lot of people tweeting, say, oh, you ought to, you know, tell them about Never 10. And it's I'm sure they know now.
Yeah.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. She's famous now, though. It's a good thing for her. She got her viral video.
And I just need to go off the reservation completely to share one of my discoveries that I'm very excited about. And that is, I've been using this for a few months. And this is a beautiful 6-port, 6D, 6.0-watt USB charger.
I have several of those.
Of the anchors?
Yeah.
Yep.
Love them. I keep buying more. I have them everywhere in the house.
Yes, exactly. It was on the occasion of me buying two more that I thought, okay, the first one proved itself. I need to share this with our audience. So it's Anker.
They make great stuff.
Amazon
really
carries it. 6.0W. And what's special about this is people may know that a USB charger is not just a 5-volt supply. You need to support some minimal USB protocol in order to get devices to understand the capabilities of the charger that they're being plugged into. So this thing is universal, and it's not easy to find one with 6 outputs because that's a lot of juice. And the other side is not a wall wart, but an actual AC cord. So inside is a little switch, a very high efficiency switching power supply that drives 6 ports. And so I just, you know, again, as I said, it's completely a non sequitur, but I love this. You can get it in black or white. It's about $32 on Amazon. And the black one, I don't know about the white one, has 2,057 5-star reviews on Amazon. So, yeah, just my recommendation.
It's a good thing. I have, as I said, I have 3 or 4 like you. It's so funny. and they just, I have them everywhere in the house. I have it in my bedside table. I have one.
It's
in
the right one.
Yeah.
I mean, it beats, because we all have so many USB charging things now. And, you know, and the normal USB adapters are big blobs that often block the adjacent port, or you have to have an octopus coming off in order to work with them. So, yeah, I waited a few months.
By the way, they now have for $100 a 10 port. If you really want to go crazy.
Wow.
How many watts is the 10 port? Yeah, still 60 watts. So see, maybe you'd be better off with fewer ports because you get more watts per port.
Yeah, and your dollars per watt has dropped a lot too.
Yeah, it's a little expensive. Amazon makes, and this is kind of interesting, an Amazon Basics that looks exactly the same, and it's $25. And I'm wondering if that's, you know, all of these companies, you just source these from Chinese companies and relabel them.
It's just private labeled.
Yeah. So it's 60 watts, 6-port USB charger. I don't know. Anker's so good. You could trust Anker. I only use Anker stuff.
I do. I've been very impressed with it, so I wanted to share it.
Good.
And one more recommendation I have is for something called SpinRite.
Oh, yeah. I heard of that.
Not surprisingly. Yeah.
Yeah.
Simon Wilcock in Manchester, in the UK, he asked a quick question. And in the spirit of this nominally being a Q&A, and we've got time for some questions here in a second. He said, Steve, a quick question. I have a friend whose introduction to her laptop was, the disk is dead.
Huh.
Can you get me a new one? She said.
Oy.
I asked if I could run SpinRite on it. She agreed, and I ran it at both level 2 and 4, and no errors were found. She is convinced that she needs a new disk. Then he says, PC World tech guy told her so.
Oh.
From what I can see, there is no problem with the disk. How confident can I be? And so, okay, what's not clear is where the original idea of the disk being dead came from. Disks can declare themselves in trouble through the so-called smart, the self-monitoring, what's the A? Self-monitoring, S-M-A-R-T, self-monitoring something and reporting tool,
yeah,
or technology.
It's, as I remember, it's not an intuitive acronym.
S-M-A-R-T, self-monitoring.
I'll look it up for you.
And report, yeah.
Is
and.
It really?
Oh, all right. I think it's self-monitoring and reporting technology. Anyway, so disks can provide a warning, and BIOSes can read that and put up a notice when you boot the machine that the disk is in trouble. SpinRite monitors.
It stands for self-monitoring analysis and reporting technology.
Analysis and reporting. Okay, thank you.
But whatever it is, it's not very smart.
No, it's not. However, if the, and this was my point, if the drive is freaked out enough to say that it's dying, I would believe it. On the other hand, SpinRite checks for that. It explicitly looks for that. And I've had people running SpinRite tell me that SpinRite suddenly put up a note saying, this drive is reporting it's near death. You may want to stop running SpinRite and back up what you can. So the fact that SpinRite ran twice on it with no such report, to me, says this entire thing was specious. And wherever this idea came from that it was dead, it was clearly wrong. So Simon, if you run SpinRite on it and SpinRite is happy, we know two things. First, that SpinRite is happy, and also that the drive is not unhappy with its own condition, because if it were, SpinRite would let you know.
SpinRite is smarter than smart.
Oh, seriously. It's way smarter than smart.
Smart was the hard drive companies didn't really want smart, so they dumbed
correct.
It down. Yeah,
kicking and screaming.
Yeah.
Compaq said, we're not going to buy from you unless you give us some means of knowing what's going on inside the black box. That was as drives became the IDE drives were the first where the controller moved into the drive, and Compaq said, look, how do we test these drives fail? We need and so actually, and Compaq was using SpinRite to pre-qualify the drives before
really?
They put them
good for
in
them.
Users' machines. Yeah,
wow, that's nice. That must have felt pretty good.
Yeah, and next week we're going to talk about Samsung and the smart things hack.
Oh,
so
yeah,
lots of interesting information there, and in general about IoT stuff, because that's gonna end up being, unfortunately, a big topic for the podcast.
Moving forward. If you have a smart drive, even if you don't, you better have a backup, and it's not too late yet. That's what Carbonite says. Go to carbonite.com. It is too late if your hard drive has died. However, the idea, it's like fire insurance. You don't buy a fire insurance on your business after the fire. You buy it now. And don't be superstitious and say, oh, I'm not going to buy disaster insurance. I'm not going to buy Carbonite because then a disaster will happen. That's silly. Don't be superstitious. Carbonite is a great way to back up. It's automatic, so you don't have to think about it. It's continuous, so you make a change, it's backed up. It's in the cloud, which means even if there is a fire or somebody steals your stuff or your hard drive dies and the backup dies and the backup of the backup dies, you still have Carbonite's amazing backup. 1.5 million homes and small businesses trust Carbonite to back up their computers, to back up their servers. Go to Carbonite.com. They've got a free trial. Pick a plan for home or office, Mac or PC. Very affordable. Starts at $5 a month for everything on a single computer. That's a great deal. Unlimited cloud storage. Go to Carbonite.com. Try it free right now. No credit card required. If you do decide to buy, make sure you use the offer code SECURITYNOW when you do the trial, because when you buy, you'll get 2 months free with purchase. And by the way, this is a very good time to try Carbonite. For a little bit longer, they're going to do that 30% off deal. And that's well worth taking advantage of now. Carbonite.com. Don't forget, offer code SECURITYNOW when you try it. That lets them know you heard it on Security Now. Give Steve a little good karma. Some karma points. Carbonite.com. Offer code SECURITYNOW. All right, we are going to pick up where we left off, right, Steve?
Yes. Yeah. Perfect.
So
I think we're gonna get the rest of these other remaining six questions. We got
no
half
problem.
An hour. Be perfect. Yeah.
Let's go. So is it Oscar Morales who's next?
It's Neil.
No, Neil Baldridge of Lubbock, Texas. Question five was where we left off last time. He's wondering about LTE safety in the light of this kind of bogus but still scary 60 Minutes piece, particularly on SS7. You mentioned last week it was unclear if SS7 eavesdropping would apply to LTE data. I've always made the assumption that LTE data would be reasonably secure, especially when compared to open Wi-Fi, but it's my assumption. It's not based on any evidence. Have you learned any more about whether SS7 vulnerabilities would allow eavesdropping on LTE data that is not specifically or otherwise encrypted, say, on an HTTPS link?
So what we know is that the cellular network itself, I mean, what 60 Minutes was right about, although this wasn't newsy, because we talked about it a couple of years before.
It's been a lot longer than that, apparently.
Yeah, it was at the Chaos Computer meeting in 2014 in the summer that this was first shown, is that the glue that knits the global cellular system together has never been secure, because what it lacks is authentication. And, you know, that's always the bugaboo. You can bring up security. You can have, negotiated keys between endpoints. But if you don't know who you're negotiating with, then even if you on the fly negotiate a key, there could be someone in the middle and you're negotiating your key with him and he's negotiating separately with the other end and knitting the conversation together, being in the middle. So, and the problem is in an electronic environment where you don't see who you're talking to, you don't know. So what we have to understand is that the cellular system lacks authentication. That being the case, we know what it means, that it isn't secure. So HTTPS, for example, now, and he mentions between a smartphone and an HTTPS banking site, HTTPS does provide authentication. That's what the certificate is. It is an assertion. That's why we talk about them so much, because they're so important. The certificate is a statement of the identity of the certificate issuer. And it's the reason certificates must be protected and kept safe, because you don't want your identity stolen. You don't want anybody else to be able to pretend that you're Bank of America or whomever. So the HTTPS, that is the TLS protocol with certificates, provides authentication. And so it doesn't matter if the channel it's transiting is insecure, is not secured, or itself provides no authentication, because the endpoints do, and the protocol protects us. So what's not secure would be standard voice conversations or standard SMS and MMS that are just that are not using any kind of a third-party wrapper or protocol. If you were to use Signal or WhatsApp or anything else that is, you know, some other technology which provides its own encryption and some means of authentication, then it doesn't matter if it's between two tin cans with a string. It's going to be, you know, that essentially you're using the carrier just to get the data across, and then the layer on top is providing safety. So if this whole S7 thing upset, you know, worries you, and you want to, for example, have a truly private voice conversation, then you need to use a third party voice app of some kind that will then, you know, provide the security.
All right. Oscar Morales in Paris, France, and Bogota, Colombia, with a question. Steve, why haven't we seen any attacks to Android phones in real life? I've been a consultant on information security for the past 10 years, and as a big fan, I've been listening for 6 years, talking to a fellow IT security consultant about Android phone security. He argued he's going to still use his little Motorola Android phone, even if it took him months to get the latest OS updates. Now, he says Motorola. I don't know what generation we're talking about here, but he says, I was speechless when he said, if it was so bad or dangerous, why, despite having more than 250 million vulnerable phones, we never hear about people being attacked or compromised due to these vulnerabilities? Now, that question's been bothering Oscar. Ars Technica announced that 950 million Android phones were at risk. That was back July 27th, 2015. In March 18th, 2016, we got news of 275 million Android phones at risk with a new vulnerability. Steve, you just mentioned another stage fright vulnerability. That seems like a good bounty, says Oscar. 275 million personal devices compromised. However, have there been even a million complaints? Has anyone noticed anything funny ringing in their pockets? Why is no one taking advantage of this? What is protecting us? Why isn't it yet the end of civilization as we know it? Thanks for your show and for the answers. I asked the same question, Steve. Why?
Yeah. If we look at history, we can see what the pattern is, which is it took us a long time to get things like Code Red and NIMDA and MS Blast. We had insecure platforms for a long time until someone decided to do those things. And frankly, look how long it took before we ended up with crypto malware. You might argue that, well, they needed some sort of an anonymous payment system, which unfortunately Bitcoin now provides them. But there is, without question, a decoupling between what could be done and what is done. We often mused about how viruses were like rampant, but they didn't destroy things. They just sort of seemed to be viruses for the sake of being viruses. They used vulnerabilities just for the sake of propagating. People were just sort of screwing around, seeing if they could make something propagate until, of course, it became profitable. And now we have crypto malware. So the fact that these phones and the Android platform is vulnerable doesn't immediately beget worms and big high-profile attacks. There were reports of people receiving MMS messages when stage fright was new. People were getting like hit all the time, and we covered it. And you know, the advice was, you know, turn off MMS, don't open those messages. People, you know, the known phone numbers of blocks of phones were being scanned just because they were there. So they weren't weaponized because, you know, because people didn't bother to do that. They were just sort of screwing around, crashing people's phones because they could. So I guess my point is that the fact that there are vulnerabilities doesn't mean that there will be automatically attacks against them. History shows us there's a, for some reason, there's a disconnect between that. And I'm thankful for it. Well, on one hand, I'm thankful for it. It would be nice if there was more pressure to fix these things, because it's a little annoying that attacks are allowed to remain outstanding until they actually are being exploited in the wild. Then it's a big panic to get them patched. That sort of is just the nature of this industry.
I also think that it's a little bit harder to exploit these platforms than merely having the exploit. That they're mobile platforms are really kind of significantly different than desktop platforms. And so I think it's going to be a little bit more difficult for people, even knowing the vulnerabilities exist.
I agree. I also think it's a bit of a higher end hack.
Yeah.
It's, you know, when you have a Windows machine with all of the debugging and developer tools and, you know, sort of everything here in front of you, even though you don't have the source, I think it's easier to build a virus for that than it is for a very complex mobile platform, which where you do have access to the source in some cases.
Right.
I think you just you have to have some motivation. I think
these mobile platforms also were designed in a post-virus world. So there are things done on these mobile platforms, Android and iOS, that weren't done on desktop operating systems.
For example, they all have address space layout randomization. Yeah.
But even they have stores. I mean, there's a whole, you know, you can download any arbitrary code you want on a Windows system. Have fun, right? It's not so trivial or easy on a mobile device.
The apps are curated.
Yeah.
Yep.
So and you know. Both iOS and Android have kill switches. They both have scanners built in that check everything you download before you run it. Windows finally has something like that, and Apple does. But this was kind of, I think security was kind of built in a little bit more on these mobile.
Well, and they had the advantage of coming in later and understanding.
Right.
I mean, like, no one today would build a browser that didn't have strong security as the first thing, you know, like as a fundamental of what they were doing, because it's, we now understand how important it was.
Right.
But the early browsers had no concept.
However, I think your point's well taken. Give it time.
Yeah.
It probably is just a matter of time at some point.
And if an individual is worried about, if they're like a high profile target, then this is the kind of thing that, you know, that the spooks, as they say in the UK, you know, they could do targeted attacks if they wanted to get somebody, rather than just, you know, 275 million people all, you know, getting a dancing bear.
Yeah. John in Montreal isn't at all sold on Signal's security. Uh-oh. Just because your copy of Signal can be verified bit for bit to be identical between your phone and some other build, it doesn't mean that WhatsApp uses that version of Signal. If Signal is a demand-loaded module, WhatsApp could even load it but not use it. Sorry to rain on your parade.
So, yeah, and again, this comes back to, well, yes, doing any of this requires that we extend some trust.
Yeah.
There is absolutely no way around that. If you want absolute security, you know, arrange to be in the physical presence of the other person and whisper in their ear. Otherwise, if you stick it on a wire, you really don't. And you didn't design every aspect of what happens to it. You have no great security.
Yeah.
I mean, so, yeah, I take John's point, but it's like, okay, what's the takeaway? What can we do? You know, mine is there's nothing I'm doing on these platforms that is really important.
Right. And it's my argument that you really don't have security unless you have open source security. And you can, you know, I mean, truthfully, it'd be better if you knew it could read all the code and understand it and vet it. And we've learned.
And of course, and Signal is. Signal is.
Right.
And so if you wanted to download the Signal app,
you'd be better off
or
building
if you wanted to
building it from source.
Yes.
Then you know what you got, right?
Yes.
And so that's, I mean, truthfully, I think it's probably good for us to spread the word, because if encryption does become outlawed or somehow modified, it'd be good for everybody to know. And it's not hard how to download code, look at it, compile it, build it yourself. That's a better, much better than a binary blob. You don't know where it came from, especially if, as he points out, it loads on demand. Yeah. You know, who knows what that is. Greg in North Hollywood wants an episode on Tor appliances, like a refrigerator. Hi,
a refrigerator, and you don't know where it is.
Anonymous refrigerator. Hi, Steve. Watching Tech Thing 68. That's Patrick Norton's show he does with Shannon Morse. And they have a Tor appliance. I have a Tor appliance in my pocket right now. Could you do a slow show, multi-part if needed, on these offerings? You could make your own Tor network appliance thingy using a Raspberry Pi, Banana Pi, Intel NUC, cheap small motherboard, etc. Or make your own private Tor using DigitalOcean, which is a sponsor we should mention. Droplets. Data centers in San Francisco, New York, Amsterdam. Yeah, you could totally do that. You could use a Tor browser. I have in my pocket here a Tor appliance. So let me let you answer, and then I will show you mine.
Oh, actually, you better show me yours, because I have no idea why this question is here. Last week, there must have been something I had to say about this.
Well, Netcat just wants to know.
So, I have no idea.
Inquiring minds. So, you know, one of the things that would be nice is to make VPN and Tor just automatic, right?
Easy.
So easy.
Yes.
So that you would just be built in. And, of course, if you built it yourself from a Raspberry Pi, you could vet the code. And you could. But this, I'm going to show you something that just breaks all the rules I just mentioned. This is a binary blob from a source I don't know, except I trust him. I've talked before about my tiny hardware firewall, tinyhardwarefirewall.com. This is the latest.
Look at that little cute thing.
Isn't that cute?
Oh, my goodness.
So you plug this into your laptop. It's a Wi-Fi to Wi-Fi device. So it's both a Wi-Fi receiver and a Wi-Fi transmitter. You plug it into your laptop. It takes about 3 or 4 minutes to boot, because as you might imagine, it's a very slow processor. But it's a little computer. And what happens is, once it boots up, you will see it as a access point on your computer with a randomly generated name and WPA2 key.
No kidding.
Yes.
So it's only getting power from the USB.
That's all
port.
It needs. I'll show you right now. Yes. I'll plug it in, and then of course you know ahead of time what the key and everything is. So this it is going to take a while to boot. So I won't be able to show you how it works in any reasonable amount of time.
Oh, look! It lit up a little green light.
Yeah, it's booting up. So then you'll join it, and once you join it, you surf in your browser to the address of this device. And you can configure it. First thing you're going to do is you're going to configure its Wi-Fi access to the open access point at the coffee shop that you're at. So you log into that, and that's how it handles captive portals and all of that.
Yep.
Once
yep.
you've logged into that, now there's a button on the website that says Engage VPN. You could choose your server and start up the VPN. There's another button that says Engage Tor. And at that point, all of the traffic coming and going from this device will be both through a VPN and through Tor.
Okay, now everybody wants to know what this is, so we have to tell them.
So this little device, and by the way, not very expensive. I've recommended these before. This is the latest from tinyhardwarefirewall.com.
Oh, those
now,
guys. Yeah.
We've mentioned them before. The thing about this is...
It's cute. For people who don't,
well,
can't
see
the video.
Well, I keep this in my pocket. It's the size
of it. It's the cutest thing I've ever seen.
It's not even as big as a USB key.
Wow.
It's all you need. Now, they make a bigger one that does Ethernet, which would be more secure, obviously. But this one is – let me look at the price. The way they sell these is a little weird, and I should just say this is one of – you could buy this device without this deal. But the way they sell these is with a year's worth of VPN from Hotspot VPN.
Ah.
So this is essentially a Hotspot VPN product. But – you know, they make. I've had the bigger one before, but these little USB ones are so tiny and easy to use. I mean, and it's got Tor built in, right?
It's just adorable.
Yeah. So this is a Tor appliance. Now you would be more secure, I admit, if you built your own out of a Raspberry Pi. So, $30, I think, for this. If you want the a year's worth of firewall plus the hardware, $91. You basically pay for the firewall, and you get the hardware for free. But if you just wanted the hardware, $35. These are cheap. This is the USB thing. It's called the Napoleon. Oh. It's $30. And so I love this idea, right?
Yep.
So I think is what they're talking about.
Yep. So the VPN gets you out of your local insecure environment,
right?
Through a VPN tunnel. And then if additionally you want Tor's promise of anonymity, and I'm calling it that rather than anonymity, because as we know, lots of attention has gone to de-anonymizing Tor users.
Fully anonymous, yeah.
Right. Location obscuring.
Yeah.
Then you turn that on and you get way worse performance, but way more secrecy.
Yeah.
Essentially.
Yeah. And it's not, this one is not cool. It's not horribly slow, I have to say.
Good.
So it's slower, but right. You're still getting a few megabits.
You're bouncing typically through three Tor nodes.
Right. You still, yeah. Speed tests, it's maybe 3 megabits down, something like that. 500K up. Enough to get email and surf the web safely.
Yeah.
So I really love this idea. And just the thing is, this makes it so easy. You just carry it around. You don't even have to put it on a laptop. In fact, you might not want to. I just have a little battery, right? One of those little portable batteries. Plug it into that. And that'll run all day. So you keep it in your backpack. And that you have in your backpack that you just log into a server. Couldn't
Very
be easier.
Very cool.
Yeah. Yeah.
Very cool.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad I was here for that one. Ramsey wonders.
Yeah, I was useless on that
like,
one.
What is an appliance or appliance? Well, that's the idea.
Why did I choose
that's
that
the
one?
Idea. And there's, you could create, as I guess Patrick and Shannon showed, you can create your own, which would be for a trust no one person like you. Probably a good idea. Ramsey's wondering about implementing key hierarchies. Love the show, blah, blah, blah. Can you explain how encryption systems can have master keys? The scenario I'm thinking of is when an employee quits and leaves behind an encrypted hard drive on a company laptop, can the company decrypt the drive? I think yes, but I can't quite figure out how the crypto would work in that case.
So, this was sort of a quick one to answer. Well, it could be. The idea is when you we'll take Ramsey's use case, you have a drive which is encrypted under some key which was arrived at randomly. So, and we'll take sort of the TrueCrypt model. That is, when you're setting up TrueCrypt, there's some source of entropy that may or may not involve the user. In a TrueCrypt, for some reason, like telling you to, move the mouse randomly around and, crazy for a while until you decide you're done and then press a button. And that always bothered me because the question was, wait a minute, people are not random. And so how much are we supposed to move the mouse? What if we don't move the mouse enough? I mean, that was just always nonsense. But it's like, okay, fine. The point is that generates the key that encrypts the drive. Now we encrypt that key. That is, so that's the master drive encryption key. So now the user provides a passphrase, hopefully long and high entropy, and so that master drive encryption key is encrypted using the user's long passphrase. But nothing, and here's where the key hierarchy essentially comes from, although this is a flat hierarchy, nothing prevents that same master hard drive key from being encrypted also under like an administrative supermaster password. So now you have two encrypted things, one which is decryptable to the hard drive master key with the user's password, and the other one which, if the administrator applies their supermaster key, decrypts to the same master hard drive password. So two people can have their own keys to the same device. And the crypto is, I mean, so, and this has always been my argument, for example, that this is like a variation of the argument on the whole decryption on demand. That is, phones could be the same way. They, you could have two separate keys, one stored by the person, the entity responsible for being able to respond to court order, you know, the administrator, and the other one is the users. And either one can be used, and neither lowers the security of the other, except in the obvious way. But from a technology standpoint, there is no difference between them, and the encryption is not outlawed or weakened or broken or anything. So that's what's so cool about these little modules, these little crypto components that we have now, is they can be put together in all kinds of ways to create any kind of interlock that we ask. And so this simple little flat one is an example of a key hierarchy, just using taking the master key and then re-encrypting it under two different keys that are known by different people.
Well, here's another kind of related question. This is about interlocking. Hendrik in Germany has a question about WhatsApp and an interlock protocol, wondering if the code comparison and WhatsApp encryption could be verified via the interlock protocol by sending alternating digits. You're going to have to explain what this all means.
So I thought that this was sort of fun. This was, we talked about how with Signal, and I want to be careful with my wording, because, you know, when we say WhatsApp, what we're talking about is the Signal protocol in WhatsApp. I'm comfortable talking about the Signal protocol because that's what's published, and it's what we know Moxie and his group have worked on in order to just nail. And boy, they got it right. So when we were talking about this a couple of weeks ago, we come back to authentication. And so what Hendrik is asking about is, could we verify the identity of the other person by sending alternating digits back and forth? And the problem is that you have to have an association between the endpoints in order to send alternating digits back and forth. Remember that you could ask the WhatsApp version of Signal to show you that key for the conversation, and that was both a QR code and a, what was it, 80 some digits? It was a lot of characters. But the idea was you could then, you know, read those to the other person and have them verify them. The problem is that if you sent them back and forth, okay, I should explain. If you did it by voice, then you would know you were talking to the other person. But if you do it in band rather than out of band, that is, if you use the protocol itself to prove the identity of the other end, though, there could still be a man in the middle. And so they would be verifying the fraudulent connection to them with each of the endpoints, and the endpoints would think that they had verified with the far end when in fact they were verifying with the man in the middle. So that's why the key is an out-of-band verification. And Leo, you did this when on the show, your two phones, you showed one of your phones the QR code. Right. That was out-of-band. That was the optical channel directly between phones, not going through the the connection. And that's what you have to do. You have to have some sort of independent verification just once. And then you absolutely want to turn on the notify me if this contact's verification ever changes. Because it's not that it absolutely can't ever, but it should absolutely raise a red flag. And I don't know why that's turned off by default. That's just nuts that it's off by default, because the contact changing is a serious, man in the middle warning. And it just ought to be part. It ought to be on by default.
Yeah.
So that's the one thing that I think they got wrong. Clearly, for convenience and usability, and because most people wouldn't know what it meant if it popped up. Unfortunately, the only reason it's really going to pop up is if there is somebody who stuck themselves in between. And the system was designed, with that authentication to prevent that. So,
nice.
Anyway, cool. You can't do it in band. You have to do it out of band.
And that, ladies and gentlemen, concludes our edition of Security Now for this
right on time.
Third day of May. Thank you, Steve. I'm just connecting up to the Tor on here so that I will be able to surf completely, not completely.
I'll
mostly
bet this is
going to
be. This will be a hit with our listeners, Leo.
Yeah,
that is I just
love
this little thing.
And the thing is, I just carry it around so that it's an easy thing to use if I'm at an open access point or a hotel.
Yep.
I got it before. I was trying to get it before the cruise because I knew I was going to be on a whole week on an open access point on the cruise ship. Their Wi-Fi, and I thought that's disaster.
Yeah.
That gives a bad guy a whole week, and there are 5,000 other people using it. I probably should have some sort of protection. Unfortunately, didn't come in time, but there you go. I don't think I got hacked. Steve, it's always a thrill, always a slice. I'm so glad.
A thrill.
It's a thrill and a chill. And we didn't mention Silicon Valley or Veep or Game of Thrones or Expansion.
Or the Night Manager.
The Night Manager, episode 2, was even better.
Yes.
It kind of started a little slow, as you said it would. Episode 2, not slow wouldn't be the word I'd use.
I can't
wow.
Wait for tonight.
I love John le Carré. I just think he is the greatest, the best spy writer, because he was a spy. He was in MI6. All right, Steve. We do this show every Wednesday, Tuesday, 1:30 Pacific, 4:30 Eastern, 20:30 UTC. You must tune in and watch. Be in the chat room. If you can't, though, don't worry. On-demand audio and video is available. Steve's site has it, grc.com. He's even got written transcripts. He's got audio at his site. He also has great stuff, including SpinRite, the world's best hard drive maintenance and recovery utility at his site, and lots of freebies. He's very generous with the freebies. You'll also find versions of the show at twit.tv/SN or subscribe in your favorite podcatcher so you won't miss an episode. And as I mentioned, leolaporte.com, my blog, leolaporte.com, has a script, several, one in Python, one in Bash, and one in PowerShell, that you can modify to your heart's content to download every single episode, if you wish, of Security Now. The PowerShell downloads from your site. I think the Python and the Bash scripts, they're very simple, by the way. You can look at them and assure yourself that there's nothing going on.
Nothing nefarious.
As I say, nothing nefarious. Thank you, Steve.
Okay, next week, IoT, I believe. We'll talk about Samsung's smart things and other nightmares with your refrigerator.
And, one of the things I really enjoy doing when I use Tor is just seeing where I am. Let me just see if I can find out. What my IP address is. If you just type IP into Google, it'll tell you where you are. Although, because it sees me coming from a Tor, it's asking me for a CAPTCHA. Just to make sure. Our systems have detected unusual traffic. I am at 128.153.145.125. And I'll have to do a who is to figure out where in the world I am. I really enjoy that.
Where in the world is Leo?
So my traffic, it bit me because I signed into Facebook, and Facebook blocked me saying, you're signing in from Cairo.
Nice.
I'm at Clarkson University right now. So there. Isn't that fun?
Who knew?
Who knew? And I could, and I'm sitting here in the brick house and just floating around. Thank you, Steve. We'll see you next time on Security.
Okay, buddy.
Security Now.